From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what primary turnout tells us in terms of politics and the expected ballot load for November.
It's been a big concern of election officials that they're not going to have enough time to go through these absentee ballots, so it's certainly on the mind of legislators in the next few months.
Also, the challenges facing scientists synthesizing a vaccine for COVID-19.
We're talking about an RNA virus, and that is especially tough to make a vaccine against. Another famous RNA virus is HIV, and we still don't have a vaccine against that.
Plus, heavy is the head that wears the crown. Miss Michigan talks about ways the pandemic changed her life.
But I'm also a first grade public school teacher, and we've seen vast changes in that job as well. And so it's really changed every aspect of my life and how I do both of those jobs.
Those stories coming up on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. Today, we walk through the process of developing vaccines.
Every vaccine is different, and it depends on whether it's a vaccine against a bacteria or a virus.
Some historically informed predictions for how soon a COVID vaccine might be ready. That's later in the show. But first, let's go over all that election action from yesterday. It was dress rehearsal last night for candidates from the Republican and Democratic primaries, hoping to get an idea of voter mood and for election managers all across Michigan. This was the first August vote in which Michigan's voters had wide access to mail-in voting in the presence of absentee ballots. There were strong reasons for this, obviously, because of the pandemic, but they may also have political consequences. Jonathan Osting is a Michigan politics reporter for Bridge Magazine, and Riley Began covers Lansing for Bridge. Riley, Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Hey, happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Could you tell us both who had you on the edge of your seats last night? Which races were you watching especially closely? Jonathan, you want to start out?
Yeah, well, I think the most surprising race for a lot of folks was the 6th Congressional District Democratic primary. John Hoadley, a state rep, had a lot of backing from national groups and seemed to be an obvious front runner for that race. But Jen Richardson came out of nowhere and made it a very competitive race. Hoadley did seemingly hang on. We're waiting for final results, but it looks like he's going to prevail. Other than that, I think, everyone was really curious to see what happened as well. In the 13th Congressional District, that was a Democratic primary, that Rashida Tlaib had a rematch with Detroit City Council President Brenda Jones. And it looked like, in that case, though, it might have been more hype than substance because Tlaib cruised pretty easily.
Yeah, that one wasn't even close, really.
No, and it was 2 years ago. I mean, recall they actually each won an election 2 years ago. Jones had won a temporary term to complete John Conyers' term, and Tlaib won the full 2-year term, and voters are sending her back for two more.
Riley, how about you? What was on your radar last night?
Some other ones that we were watching was the 3rd Congressional District in West Michigan. Peter Meyer won that. He had several other Republicans running against him in the GOP primary that was really competitive. That district is a little bit more of a swing district now than it used to be, but he definitely has the advantage in the fall. So that was one that we watched. And then another one was the 10th district in the Thumb, where Shane Hernandez, who is one of the appropriations chair in the legislature, did not come out on top, and he lost, I believe, to Lisa McLean, who's more of a conservative, and she has a real advantage as well in the fall.
Right. Were there any trends to be seen for the two parties overall? I kind of felt like I was noticing Republican voters leaning toward the middle, electing candidates like Peter Meyer in the 3rd Congressional District.
Well, certainly that was the case in the 3rd district, but as Riley mentioned, that wasn't necessarily the case in the 10th. McLean ran very far to the right in that race and aligned herself very closely with President Donald Trump. And that's saying something, because Shane Hernandez is known as a conservative in the state legislature, so he wasn't exactly a moderate either. Now, that district, the 10th, is one of the most reliably Republican in the state. The 3rd district, seemingly, the candidate that was the most moderate, which was Peter Meyer, is probably going to be best positioned in that general election because it is going to be tighter probably than past elections there. That's the seat that Justin Amash currently holds, but he's not running for re-election. And I think, you know, for instance, we're going to see in the sixth too, you know, a moderate candidate, incumbent, Fred Upton, has done very well in that district, even though it's trending, you know, there are a lot of signs say it's suggest it's trending towards Republicans. He's had to run as a moderate, and he's done pretty well doing that in the past. So John Hoadley, who I mentioned earlier, is going to face a strong, you know, uphill fight there to knock off Fred Upton. So, you know, I think it really depends on the district. But of course, where there is a competitive district, typically you're going to see a more moderate candidate get backing from the party insiders and the folks who think that candidate actually has a chance of winning in the general.
Riley, did you see anything happening last night that will be consequential in the upcoming legislative sessions in Lansing once new office holders get installed?
Yeah, I mean, I think something that we're going to be watching through the next few months before November is what happens in terms of policy around absentee voting and other sort of election-related policy before November. I mean, obviously, we're gonna have to see what happens after November when the new House comes into play. Or they prepare for the new House to come into play. But in the meantime, we're going to be looking at a number of policies that would allow for pre-processing of absentee ballots, which is something we can get into further. But it's been a big concern of election officials that they're not going to have enough time to go through these absentee ballots. So it's certainly on the mind of legislators in the next few months.
Well, speaking of absentee ballots, do either of you know what the statewide turnout looked like yesterday in terms of in-person voters versus folks who mailed it in?
So we don't have final vote or final numbers right now on absentee versus in-person voters, but we do know that about 1.6 million people voted absentee yesterday. That is a record-breaking number. It beats out 1.27 million in the 2016 November general election. And as we all know, the November presidential general election brings out a lot more people than the August primary. So we can expect those numbers to even increase this fall.
I wonder if there was anything that happened on this election day that tells us about voter enthusiasm. You know, whoever has the voters who are most enthusiastic about getting their ballots in generally wins the day. So were there any indications last night of who should feel pretty good going into the fall, Jonathan?
Well, I think we still have to see the total turnout figures before we can draw huge conclusions on that front. And of course, you know, turnout in a primary is a little different because it can really depend on if there were any competitive races in you know, the district in which a voter lives. So, you know, here in Ingham County, where I live, there were only one competitive race on each side of the Republican or Democratic primary, which probably didn't, you know, inspire huge enthusiasm from voters. But certainly election experts that we've talked to and pollsters are expecting the presidential is going to be a huge turnout election. The enthusiasm is very high from Democrats and Republicans. And I think what's going to be really interesting to see then is how absentee balloting plays out in the general. As Riley mentioned, we saw a lot of absentee voting in the primary, but we also saw some indications, at least it's early, not all figures are in, but some indication that President Donald Trump's warnings about mail-in ballots might have had a larger effect on Republican voters, you know, discouraging them from voting at as high of a rate by absentee. So, for example, in Kent County, it's a purple district, you know, purple region. In the U.S. Senate race, Gary Peters, the Democratic incumbent, 74% of the votes he got in the yesterday's primary came from absentee voters. Republican John James, 54% of his votes came from absentee voters. We saw similar trends in Oakland County and Wayne County. And that Senate race is one where neither of them had an opponent. So it's pretty much just a litmus test of party enthusiasm. And at least in those areas, we've seen that that Democrats were much more likely to cast an absentee ballot, which in a high turnout election, if it carries through to the general, could have real implications.
Based on last night's results, let's hear from both of you what you're paying attention to and what questions you have as we lurch toward November. You've said, of course, that absentee ballots still have a lot to tell us, depending on how the final results look. Anything else?
One thing that I'm going to be watching in terms of voting mechanics here, in Michigan, we have a couple of things that are sort of complicating factors. If you send your ballot to the clerk and it gets there after Election Day, it doesn't count. So that's different than a lot of states where if you postmark it by Election Day, it'll still be counted. I'm sure you've been hearing some of these stories about the U.S. Postal Service causing big delays. And as they are struggling with funding, they're facing some threats at the national level over funding. It's not clear that they're going to be able to sort of keep up a real speed in the fall. So we're going to be interested in seeing whether that affects how many people's votes actually count in November. I think that's going to be interesting.
Right. Jonathan, how about you?
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting to take a look at both the primary and now the upcoming general election through the lens of the redistricting process. This is the last election cycle that we're going to see under the maps that were drawn and approved by the Republican-led legislature back in 2011. A lot of dynamics have changed since then. Those maps seemingly were designed to give Republicans an advantage, but there's been a lot of like changing demographics and trends. I mean, you know, we see it in Oakland County, for instance. 2 years ago, Alyssa Slotkin and Haley Stevens, now both in Congress, flipped GOP districts that include parts of Oakland County. You know, those were traditionally Republican strongholds. So those maps, that map advantage is kind of breaking down here in the last year, the last election anyways, under these maps. So I'm going to be taking a look at, you know, how many competitive races there actually are and what implications that has both for the makeup of Congress, but also state house races.
Well, thank you both so much for talking to us about this, and I hope you can get off the phone and get a little rest. I can only imagine it was another late night last night.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having us. We always appreciate it.
Sometimes the best thing about elections is when they are over. This year obviously held some major logistical challenges for everyone working to ensure that the democratic process could proceed smoothly. We've checked in before with Ottawa County's clerk, Justin Roebuck, and he's here now to tell us how things went yesterday. Justin Roebuck, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, April.
So how late did you and your team knock off last night?
Well, we were here until about 2:30 or so, as we obviously wait for not only the results to come in, but then election materials have to be physically delivered to the county clerk by election night or after things wrap up, I should say. Results reported at about 1:30, but we were here for another hour or so. So not bad overall.
Justin, could you tell us what the county's count was for voters who opted to go absentee and mail in their ballots versus people who wanted or needed to vote in person, and maybe compare that with what you saw in the presidential primary or last year?
Yeah, yesterday was a record turnout for us, both in terms of the actual number of voters, in terms of the percentage of voters who participated overall, but definitely a record turnout of absentee voters as well. So we had about a 34.2% turnout, and that, at least in the past 20 years, was a record for an August primary. 68% of those ballots were cast absentee.
Wow.
So, you know, a huge number of people opted for that option, and it was very successful in terms of both, you know, the convenience for the voter, but also a tremendous relief on our election workers who had other challenges to deal with related to the pandemic, as they were sanitizing voting stations and ensuring social distancing in the precinct. So it was a huge help on that end of things as well.
Did you have a lot of people volunteer to work the polls this year?
We did. I think we had a really successful, you know, our typical pool of election workers, honestly, we had a great number of those folks stay on and say, you know what, we want to help in this process and we want to, you know, make sure that we're doing our part. And that was, you know, both really encouraging to us, but also, you know, encouraging that they were joined by a number of new folks who came on board. The state has done a great job in recruitment efforts through the Democracy MVP program, which is kind of the statewide recruitment effort of the Secretary of State's office. A lot of those names have been passed on to county and local clerks, obviously. But I think that's definitely one of our top priorities moving into the November election is election worker recruitment.
Justin, when you and I talked last winter, you had some serious concerns about the deluge of mail-in ballots and that it might lead to several things, among them possibly a financial crisis for clerks who might need folks to work overtime and would really be under pressure to produce results in a timely fashion. Did you feel like you had what you needed?
You know, I do feel like our August process, our August primary process was very successful in terms of the resources that we had available. State provided a CARES Act grant that was basically a matching grant funding additional equipment for the counting of absentee ballots. And we definitely took advantage of that here in Ottawa County, you know, beefed up our numbers in terms of the number of pieces of equipment used to tabulate ballots. We also looked at increasing staffing. A lot of our local clerks added, you know, even temporary help prior to election day in their offices as they needed to process absentee ballots. So that was successful. But I think, you know, as we look at the August numbers, we had 34% turnout, which is good for an August primary. But obviously a November general is much more along the lines of a 70% turnout. You know, we have 210,000 registered voters here in Ottawa County. I would predict that we could have upwards of 100,000 ballots cast absentee in November.
So what's on your mind then, knowing what you know now from both the presidential primary and the August primary, what are your priorities for the next few months?
I think we're going to focus a lot on recruitment of election workers and training of those workers. We're going to focus heavily on our absentee counting boards, giving the clerks the resources they need in terms of the training and organizational aspect of absentee counting boards, ensuring that they're, you know, starting at the earliest possible time and making sure that, you know, they have the tools and resources they need there. And frankly, I think we will very likely need additional equipment. I think what we are looking for from the legislature is are some additional tools, such as, you know, the flexibility in when ballots can be counted, the flexibility of possible in the realm of in-person voting, the possibility of combining precincts or creating vote centers where, you know, multiple precincts can be located in the same large facilities that would help with social distancing and also the convenience factor of making sure that the locations are convenient to voters, but that also we have enough staffing at the precinct level. And we can really combine resources in a vote center type of environment and devote more, human resources and human capital to counting of absentee ballots where it's likely to see the majority of votes cast.
Justin Roebuck is the clerk for Ottawa County. Justin, it's very good to hear your voice. I hope you and all yours are safe and taking care.
Well, you as well, April. Appreciate all you guys do. And thanks for having me.
One public official's term has been extended without benefit of election due to the pandemic. That's the term of Miss Michigan, Mallory Rivard. She's from Bay City, and she was crowned in June of 2019. And it's looking like she's going to hold on to that title until June 2021. Mallory Rivard, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is crazy. Does this make you the longest-serving Miss Michigan ever?
Yes, I guess I'm going to be in the history book now. unfortunately, because of COVID-19, we've had to postpone the Miss Michigan competition and as well as the Miss America competition. But it is definitely a new, unique way that I'm able to continue to serve the great state. And I've competed for the job of Miss Michigan for over 7 years. So it's a little bit bittersweet that I get to hang on to it just for a little bit longer.
You know, so much of what your job entails is being out meeting with people, you know, going to events and shaking hands and sometimes giving hugs to little girls who just look at you and see a princess. How has your role changed?
It's changed tremendously. So this is my job as Miss Michigan that I meet face to face with people, but I'm also a first grade public school teacher, and we've seen vast changes in that job as well. And so it's really changed every aspect of my life and how I do both of those jobs. I mean, I'm doing a lot of meetings virtually now. I'm connecting with families and citizens of Michigan virtually. Obviously, lots of plans have changed, but at the same time, I've just learned to be incredibly flexible and just remember that everyone in the state of Michigan and around the United States and even the world is going through this, and that we'll get through it together.
What have you learned about holding the attention of 6 to 7-year-olds on screen?
It is a lot harder than you think. Man, I am so such an animated person in general. People walk by my classroom and they're like, oh yeah, that's Mallory, like singing songs, dancing, making a fool out of herself. But then you limit yourself to just a screen and a camera. Oh, no, it's been interesting. And I just try to remember that every family is going through something different. And if I can at least just bring a smile to one child's face or one mom's heart, I mean, that is just what really that's really my goal at the end of the day.
You know, as you mentioned, you had competed for Miss Michigan before, and you had been a runner-up, correct?
Yeah, so I competed 7 times for the job of Miss Michigan.
Warrior.
Yeah, talk about resiliency. I learned that one the hard way. The last 2 years competing, I was the first runner up, which in my family, we joke and we call it the first loser because you're like the second place person.
Okay, that's harsh. Okay.
It's just a joke between my dad and I. And it's such an honor to not only be the first runner up, but at the same time, you're so close yet so far away. Ultimately, that 7th year was the charm. I accredit it to having more life experience, honestly. Like I said, I'm a first grade public school teacher, and I've taught for 3 full years now. And those life experiences, I think, really enabled me to bring more to the job of Miss Michigan.
Mallory Rivard is Miss Michigan 2019, 2020, and hey, who knows, maybe 2021 as well. Mallory, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Millions of young people are headed to campus this fall in the middle of the global pandemic. Still, for incoming freshmen, this is something they've likely been looking forward to ever since they got that acceptance letter.
Hey!
Hey! Congratulations!
That is community high school senior Cami Tirico and her parents, screaming, clapping, and quite literally jumping for joy when they found out that Cami got into her dream school. But the story Cami tells on Michigan Radio's podcast, Kids These Days, is not about that day. It's about every day that led up to it. And it's about what people do or don't do to get into the college of their dreams.
I remember the first time I opened the Common App portal. I was sitting with my mom in my basement. We were going over the app together. And there's the section where you can list up to 10 activities, and you get 250 characters to describe each one. I said out loud to my mom, "It feels so weird that my 12 years of basketball get boiled down to 17 words. She asked me,
"Do you regret any of it?"
And I said, "Of course not. I mean, no. I wouldn't have run any slower at practices or skipped any games, but it still feels a bit weird. 12 years, 5 teams, and hundreds of games. That's what this huge part of my life gets boiled down to, just a couple of sentences. It makes me wonder, what's the college process doing to our sense of self? Does it help us discover things we're interested in, or do we waste our time doing things we don't enjoy, just for the sake of filling in all of those blanks on our college application?
When I was in high school, we called it college suck, and it was the stuff you did to suck up to a college, which is so inauthentic.
That's Whitney Bruce. She's a college coach. She charges on average $3,500 to help students and their families navigate the college process. She worked with my family when my mom and I were in our 10th hour of editing the same 300-word essay. It feels like the college decision is the end-all be-all. There's so much pressure to get into the right college.
For most families, this is a huge financial decision. This is a decision that has ramifications on where a student lives and what kind of job opportunities they pursue and things like that, way beyond 4 years.
So we pour everything we've got into this college application. We're talking every club, sport, instrument, dance, or theater group we've been a part of, plus any volunteer work or job we've had, in the hopes that we will look well-rounded enough to get into our dream school. There are people like Whitney Bruce who tell us it's okay to only pursue the important things, but it often feels like we should be doing it all, and many of us try to. A study out of UCLA asked students if they felt overwhelmed by all they had to do. In 1985, only 18% said yes. In 2010, it jumped. Nearly a third of students said yes. And last year, in 2019, more than 40% of kids said they felt overwhelmed. Students are getting busier and busier, and they are sacrificing because of it.
Well, kids don't have fun anymore.
That is Sunia Luther. She studies distress and resilience among teenagers across socioeconomic groups in the U.S. I talked to her to see if this college pressure is something all teens deal with.
Kids don't have a childhood. They work at school work, and then even the playtime is really work because you're expected to, you know, win those championships and everybody's watching and you're being judged and there's a cost to whether you win or lose.
Luther says that teens feel like they're always being judged, like someone's always watching, and I agree.
What kind of childhood is that?
In Luther's research, she often talks about a phenomenon called
I can, therefore I must. If you have the opportunity to do one extra, honors course or extracurricular activity or something else to make your resumes look a little more impressive than they already are, then you must. In other words, there really isn't an option to turn away from that and say, nope, I think I'm tired. I think I've had enough. I'm not going to do this.
I know Ann Arbor isn't like all cities. It's a big university town, so there is an obvious stress on education, and not to mention it's a pretty wealthy city. This stress to be perfect and get into the best college feels really real. I knew it was a privilege to worry about what college I was going to go to get help from a college coach, and even to take my standardized tests more than once. But it wasn't until I talked to Luther that I realized class is a big factor in terms of how much students feel this pressure to succeed.
What people are finding is a sort of U-shaped curve. So the highest levels of distress or trouble tend to be at the lowest levels of socioeconomic status and the highest levels. There is this sort of implicit belief, I think, among students and parents and families and everybody is getting into college somehow is what's going to make or break your life. It's so not true.
My high school counselor, Amy McLaughlin, sees how this plays out every day at school. A lot of the kids in my school have parents who are doctors, lawyers, and professors. But before she came here, she worked at a school in Ohio with a very different mix of kids.
We didn't have these conversations about my kid will go to Columbia or my kid will go to this top-tier school. It's just the way it is. So I think where we are in the bubble of Ann Arbor, which is probably true for most college towns, I think the level of education, I think we have been told that the system is you get into a good school, you have this network of people, and then they're going to help you be successful because of who you know, which is life is about who you know. And so I think parents want to set that up for their kids.
Amy wouldn't tell me how many, but she said there's been quite a few students who have cried in her office over this.
Nobody feels good. It doesn't seem like anybody feels good about this process.
But still, if you want to go to college, you need to apply. Amy looks at it this way. She says, tell it like a story. Tell your narrative the best way you can so colleges can see the best version of yourself.
I think I would consider myself a successful counselor if I could get students to question more about why you're doing what you're doing and how that narrative fits you.
Of course, finding that narrative can be stressful too. Having it be judged, then worrying if it was good enough or if it was truly authentic. But the truth is, no matter what happens, you either get in or you don't. And there's all that stuff that's going to come with it. Am I good enough? Will I make friends? What about a job? And that's all going to be equally as stressful, if not more. But that's in the future. That's not now. Now, we celebrate.
Awesome.
Support for kids these days comes from the Michigan Health Endowment Fund, a philanthropic foundation working to improve the health of Michigan residents with a focus on the wellness of children and older adults. More at mihealthfund.org. And from the Children's Foundation, working to improve the health and well-being of children and their families with pediatric research, education, community benefit programs, and other initiatives. On the web at yourchildrensfoundation.org. Anyone else ever catch themselves imagining what everything's going to be like, quote, when this is all over and we finally have a vaccine? It's a pretty bright and shiny prospect, and for good reason. This has been an immensely difficult time for so many people in the state's communities. In addition to the hardship, there are the many, many lives lost. But what is the process of making a vaccine actually like, and what happens once it's finished? We're checking in today with Dr. Howard Markell, medical historian at the University of Michigan, to learn more about the history of vaccine development and what a COVID vaccine will or won't mean when it's ready. Howard, good to have you back.
Nice to be here, April.
Before we dive in on the history end of things, could you walk us through what the basic steps of the vaccine making process look like today?
Well, every vaccine is different, and it depends on whether it's a vaccine against a bacteria or a virus. Let's take, for example, the polio vaccine, which was announced to be effective here at the University of Michigan on April 12, 1955. Jonas Salk used a method for that vaccine of taking, there were three strains of polio, took those strains of polio and inactivated or killed those viral strains in formaldehyde and then made a vaccine out of it. So that's a killed virus vaccine. Mm-hmm. And then there are live attenuated viral vaccines where you take the virus and put it through generation after generation until it loses its ability to cause disease. But if injected into, say, a human being, it will still create an antibody response and an immune response to it. And that's what the Sabin oral vaccine for polio did that many of us took. I remember taking mine at the age of three and thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread because it was on a sugar cube. I thought every vaccine should be like that.
Right.
In the case of COVID, we're talking about an RNA virus, and that is especially tough to make a vaccine against. Another famous RNA virus is HIV, and we still don't have a vaccine against that. So they are probably taking little pieces of the genome of the RNA virus of COVID. That's what they're doing right now. And using the pieces that cause the best antibody and T cell response to it. So they have to do that, then they have to test it. There are several phases for the testing to make sure it is safe. Right now, there are two vaccines that are in their phase three test on about 30,000 people per vaccine. Some of those people will get a placebo or a blank vaccine, or maybe even a vaccine to another virus, and the other a certain amount will get the actual vaccine. That's called a blinded, hopefully a double-blinded random trial, and then they'll go on and test that once again. But, you know, after that, there are licensing things that you must do. There are manufacturing things that must be accomplished. And you have to make, in this case, over 300 million doses just for Americans. And that's hoping that there's only one dose that's needed. It might be a double dose type vaccine. So there's a lot of time, work, and effort that is ahead of us for a COVID vaccine.
I always wondered, when we talk about the costs of developing a vaccine, which part is really responsible for the high cost? Is it the research and development or more the trial phase of development?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly, R&D costs a fortune. because you're hiring really good scientists to come up from scratch, you know, for a new recipe for a new vaccine. And this is a new virus because it's never been before dealt with by human beings. Unlike the flu vaccine, for example, a new strain might come up, but we already know how to make it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the testing is extremely expensive because that has to be done perfectly or as close to perfectly as possible. And the manufacturing process can be very expensive as well. So all in all, it's truly a fortune. And that's why vaccines can cost so much, like the HPV vaccine that's developed against human papillomavirus costs several hundred dollars per dose. And the reason is that there's so much already paid for by the company that makes it, both in R&D and testing it. So it's everything.
All of the above.
All of the above.
So what are the lessons about vaccine development that you take away from, say, the polio vaccine or some of the other processes in American history?
Well, you don't want to cut corners, and you want to be very careful at every step of the way in testing and developing it. You know, the polio vaccine, the Salk vaccine, was ready in 1954. And then it was handed over to Thomas Francis, who was a professor of epidemiology here at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He was also an expert at vaccine trials and influenza vaccines in particular. And so over a year, he recruited some 1.8 million children. And about 600,000 of them got the real shot, and the rest got a placebo. And he used children of different ages, different grades in school, and so on, to meticulously test this vaccine so he could announce on April 12, 1955, that it was safe, potent, and effective. Well, parents back then were so scared of the risk of polio that they pushed their kids to the head of the line to be in the test, not the actual vaccine, but the test. Can you imagine that happening today?
Not with COVID.
Not for COVID, right. And then once it was announced that it was effective, about a week into it, hundreds of thousands of batches made by the Cutter Laboratories Incorporated turned out to have a live polio strain in their vaccine. Ugh. And thousands of kids got polio, and a couple of hundred were left with paralysis, and 10 actually died. But what's remarkable about that incident is that it was announced, it was fixed, and it turned out to be just a blip on the horizon because parents still went and waited in line to get their kids vaccinated against polio. If that happened today, that would be the end of that particular vaccine, and it surely would not help the vaccination of children in general.
What kinds of regulations are in place now for making something like that less likely to happen these days? I'm sure everyone who's thinking or hearing about clinical trials would like to know.
Well, there are a whole slew of regulations that the FDA requires before they will approve a vaccine. And a lot has to do with how effective is it, for example. You know, most vaccines are none are 100% effective. But if you could get a vaccine that's 90-odd% effective, that's cause for joy. Some are only 50 to 70% effective, and that's maybe what we see with this one. They'll also be testing the purity, the way it's made. Is it a killed virus or a live attenuated virus? What are the processes when you make a live attenuated virus to prevent it from going live and bad? And also the various agents you use for preserving that. You might remember a while ago, a very common vaccine preservative is called thimerosal, which contains mercury. And while that wasn't found to cause problems in terms of the mercury itself, a lot of people objected to their children being injected with a mercurial agent, and so that was removed as a preservative. So those kinds of things are all part of the licensing process. You also have scientists at the FDA looking and scrutinizing the testing process to make sure that what the vaccine people say is actually true.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with the University of Michigan's Dr. Howard Markell about the history of vaccine development. Howard, you kind of alluded to this, but there was a time when the government or research institutions were much more deeply involved in making vaccines. We're in a market now where pharmaceutical companies are really the main engine of that. Do you think there is a case to be made for the balance shifting back the other way?
Yeah, I've long actually advocated that, and you're absolutely right. For a long time, government in the form of, say, municipal health departments or state health departments made vaccines. And for example, in the state of Michigan, the public health department used to make vaccines all the time. And the city of New York used to make vaccines and even had a stable of horses where they made diphtheria antitoxin by injecting diphtheria into horses and then drawing off blood and spitting off the serum. By the 70s, a lot of governments stopped making vaccines, and various drug companies or pharmaceuticals made them, but they found the liability issue a little bit too risky. Even though there is now a federal law, the Vaccine Act of 1975, to prevent or limit the liability, very few pharmaceutical companies want to get involved, particularly in diseases where there's not a big market. So, for example, you would not find an American company likely to take on a dengue fever vaccine or a Zika virus vaccine because they wouldn't make any money out of it. So there's actually very few companies who make this nowadays. And I would wholeheartedly agree that the United States government ought to take this over and have its own vaccine producing facility.
I mean, can you think of any way to overcome some of the liability issues that stand in the way?
Well, the best way is to make a pure and effective vaccine. But in the end, these are biological agents, and there is a chance, very small and remote, that something might go wrong. You know, most of the vaccine suits have not been successful because they could not link the actual vaccine to the cause of a particular disease. And there are, of course, federal laws that limit the liability of what somebody can sue a company for. But the best way is to make a good vaccine, but we all are taking a tiny risk when we roll up our sleeves. And what we need to do is weigh the risk and the benefits. The risk of getting COVID and getting sick or getting one of your loved ones sick is far greater, I hope, than the effective vaccine that we will develop that's thoroughly tested and thoroughly vetted and thoroughly licensed.
Right. So what are some of the specific challenges that you see scientists facing as they try to work on the COVID-19 vaccine?
Well, it's a tough virus in many respects. It's very stealthy, but there are some very promising vaccine trials going on. I really see the biggest risk is not so much of the scientists who are working on vaccines, both at the Moderna company and at the Oxford University group, as well as, you know, dozens of others, but the social or political aspects of it. So I am concerned that a vaccine might be rushed to the marketplace. You know, the very name of the project, Warp Speed. I mean, it's probably never a good idea to name your vaccine project after something from Star Trek. But you know that it might be.
Are you referring to Project Warp Speed? I assume.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Warp Speed. So I do worry about, you know, it being rushed to the marketplace as a sort of October surprise, and you know, a lot of Americans are too. We already have many, many people who are anti-vaccination in general before COVID ever developed. The anti-COVID people are joined by the libertarians and several other people who find this or believe this to be a false entity that the government is just using to take control of the American people, and other conspiracy theories that are simply not true. And, you know, I was reading the other day, it was in the New York Times, a report of interviews among the African-American community who feared a government-sponsored vaccine, particularly one that was endorsed by President Trump, and were hearkening that back to the Tuskegee syphilis study. Well, you can't think of a worse group to opt out than the African-American community, because they have been so heavily challenged by COVID thus far during this pandemic. And yet their reasons for being upset about it or concerned about it vis-a-vis the Tuskegee syphilis study are not imaginary. So we have a lot of public relations to be doing.
Yeah. Let's say, let's hope that we get to a safe and effective vaccine relatively soon. What do you project about who's going to get it and how it'll be distributed?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, there are two contracts, one with Pfizer and one with Johnson & Johnson, each to make about 100 million lots of vaccine. Now, this is assuming it's a one-time vaccine, not a vaccine that you take, say, in January, and then have to take a booster in June. So I don't know that. But that's already 200 million lots, and we have about 350 million Americans. And a lot of bioethicists have been arguing or debating who should go first. Should it be elderly people? Should it be the people who are at greatest risk because of other health conditions that they might have? Should it be the young people who might be asymptomatic carriers? And that all needs to be sorted out. And what my hope is that we'll be creating enough vaccine for those who want it to get it. You know, there's a very cautionary tale here. In 2009, when we were experiencing the H1N1 influenza pandemic, in late April, early May, when it was particularly new and scary, if you asked 100 Americans who wanted a flu vaccine for H1N1 that year, about 90 would raise their hands and say yes. Once the H1N1 vaccine was ready in the fall of 2009, only 20% of Americans got it. There was plenty for all, but only 20% actually went to their doctors, rolled up their sleeves, and took the shot. Fewer than 5% of the African American community and the Latinx community each volunteered to get the vaccine. So that's an interesting figure, too. And that is not surprising. We see this with flu vaccine all the time. So I do worry by the time there is a COVID vaccine, not everybody will get it.
Presumably, some of it is simple access to health care.
Yeah, there's access to it. There's cost, although the United States government says it will bear the cost of it. There's waiting in line for it. You might just get tired of it. And then there's also who might have COVID fatigue and just say, forget it. It's hard to imagine, and this is a perverse thing to say, but I hope we're turning people away for a while, because that means more people want the vaccine than we have it, and then we'll make more. Generally, with these kinds of things, we have a lot more on hand than those who want it.
Dr. Howard Markell is a medical historian with the University of Michigan. Howard, always nice to talk to you, and thanks for giving us something to hope for in the remaining months of the year.
My pleasure, April. Stay well.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Take care of yourself. We'll catch you on Thursday.